discover the country, to get outside the box of history and discover the country and the people on my own. And as you mentioned, after the earthquake, so many pundits, so many people talking about Haiti, the failed state, Haiti, the pariah, Haiti, the most impoverished. Yes, those things are true and not to be minimized, but it's an inability to see what we were talking about earlier, the full complexity of the culture and how rich it is in other things that we are lacking. So, you know, it was that kind of seeing that happened to me also on the trip, not just the tragic things, but the richness and the things that we can learn from Haiti. So it's really about, you know, changing a dynamic, a history, one friendship, one imagination at a time. When you write about it, you're changing maybe a reader's mind about it. And there's a wonderful quote, a favorite of mine, by Seamus Heaney from a poem, The Cure at Troy. And the stanza is, history says don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. You know, you can work towards that hope and history rhyming. And I think that's the energy, the vision, the power behind wanting to go to this wedding in Haiti.
I have another question related to the current state of affairs for Haitians living in the Dominican Republic. But before I get to that, I was curious, I was wondering how the community in the Dominican Republic and Haiti have responded to your book, as well as the diasporatic communities.
Well, I was amazed and astonished to learn from Edwige Tanticat that her books have never been translated into Creole, and she's a Haitian American writer, because there just isn't the money and the readership. And so I don't even know how it has been. I don't even think it's been read in Haiti. It just did get published in Spanish in the Dominican Republic. I have not heard that much in terms of a response, more so from the Dominican diaspora community. Many of them who are, they've come to this country, they've really changed their minds and perspectives, and they've learned about things like the genocide from books like Edwige Tanticat's The Farming of the Bones. And so I think part of what the book does is that it helps confirm and affirm something that the Dominican diaspora, Haitian American diaspora, already are doing in terms of understanding that, you know, we are one small human family on a small planet of diminishing resources, and we've got to learn to work together. So I think it's had positive, impact or response in this culture, in this country. In the Dominican Republic, I don't really know. I don't really know. But again, you know, as a writer, you just have to do the work and tell the story and plant the seed. And one of the things that I've learned is that change might not happen during my watch. But if I'm not one of the ones, you know, that puts my check mark on the side of light, my vote is not going to count. So I just have to keep doing the work. I don't know. It would be interesting. As you say, now in the Dominican Republic, in September, the highest court in the land, the Constitutional Tribunal Constitucional, like the Supreme Court, passed a ruling saying that all peoples born in the Dominican Republic, born in the Dominican Republic, who heretofore considered themselves citizens because they were born there, unless they could prove, had documented proof that their parents or grandparents were legally in the country at the time of their birth, they were instantly denationalized. In other words, and this was made retroactive to 1929. So people who have been maybe two generations thinking of themselves as Dominicans suddenly find themselves now, and this is the current situation, without a nationality, stateless. And of course, the majority of the people that it affects are the 250,000 upwards of Dominicans of Haitian descent. I can't say they're Haitians living in the Dominican. They're Dominicans. So, yeah. So, you see, part of the urgency that I felt in telling this story is, you know, the dictator might be dead, but the mentality is alive and well. That massacre mentality, that othering of the of someone else that allows that to happen, it's not just the dictator. There's got to be a culture that enables that somehow. And obviously it continues to this day in a legal way, you know, disappearing people in a legal way rather than, you know, by a physical massacre. But it's there, and it's troubling, very troubling.
You and Dominican-American writer Juno Diaz and Haitian-American writer Edwige Dandika had written a letter to the editor of the New York Times talking about this terrible situation, and then I think an ambassador had written back. What is the current situation after you all had brought more awareness to this issue by writing those letters?
So far it hasn't changed, but more and more pressure is being brought to bear on the government and, you know, on the court. And they've dug their heels in, but the pressure continues, not just from our, you know, from our letter, but I think it was some National Lawyers Association was going to have their annual conference there, and they canceled. And a lot of human rights organizations have registered their protests. And so there's a lot of pressure on the government and a lot of self-righteousness on the other side. The reaction there to us was to call us traitors, you know, betraying our nation, bad-mouthing us internationally, and saying that we weren't patriots, that we shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be allowed back in the country. I mean, the really exaggerated xenophobes who are just as few, but they managed to rile up the people, you know, with this kind of rhetoric. So it's still a struggle. It's still a struggle that is going on. And, you know, it's all we can do is we're going to do Border of Lights. Last year when we did it, we couldn't get the permits that we had before. So those young Dominican Americans and other Americans that joined us there, they're so savvy. We had an online vigil. And from 8 to 10, people could join us. My students in Middlebury, friends that were in Canada, in Europe, they all at that time went online and joined us in a virtual vigil. So you can do this stuff also, you know, because of the amazing technology. And they would not have, this would have gone down with not a, you know, with not a a word from anybody, quietly, maybe a few protests internally. But it's a powerless population. Nothing would have happened. But it, you know, I think, yeah, a global awareness, yeah.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts on this edition of Stage and Studio. And this is an interview with author Julia Alvarez. While we've been discussing the difficulties in the relationship of Dominicans and Haitians, it is in part due to the harsh dictatorship of Rafael Trujillo, who reigned from 1930 to 1961 in the Dominican Republic. During this time, four sisters by the name of Mirabal successfully began a resistance movement against Trujillo. They called themselves the Mariposas, or butterflies. In 1960, Trujillo ordered the assassination of the four Mirabal sisters. By happenstance, one of the sisters, Dede Mirabal, survived this tragic event. She has been telling the story of her revolutionary sisters for over 50 years. Julia Alvarez met Dede Mirabal, learned her story, and published the book In the Time of the Butterflies back in 1995. They have been close friends ever since. In February of this year, Dede Mirabal passed away. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_studio or tweet us at @StageNStudio.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I'm at that age, I just turned 64, where I'm losing all the old ones. And I also, it's not just family members, it's people that are in my family of as a writer, whom I've met through the experience of my work and my craft. And they, whom I, very brazenly, I was around I became close to the family, and everybody calls her, all the kids, her sister's kids too, call her Mama Dede. So I started calling her Mama Dede. Yeah. So she was, you know, she was very much a figure, that was very important for me beyond the covers of the book. It became a strong friendship and relationship. And, I just think that, she was, what's amazing about they, of course, the three heroic sisters who were murdered are the ones, you know, that are famous in some ways. But they had the heroism of for so many years. She really modeled for us how to move beyond that dictatorship. She never forgot. She always was telling the story. Nobody could shut her up, but she also could forgive, because within families, there would be people who had been part of the dictatorship and people who had been in the resistance. And how were we going to move forward? Just divide ourselves in civil wars and hatred and revenge? So she showed in a very quiet way. And to me, that's the hardest heroism, the heroism of the everyday. You know, she showed up. She made a museum out of the house that they had lived in. Or, you know, by the end of her life, every school children cycled through there. It's always a field trip because they have become the big heroines now. And she was, every afternoon she was there, sitting in the galleria. They'd come out and then they'd meet Doña Dede. And she said the most interesting, poignant question is that, you know, the little kids, they would come up and they would meet her, their little mouths open, and their first question would be, but why didn't they kill you too? That's the question that, you know, that touched the nerve in her, because that's the question she asked herself. Why didn't I die too? I died for this day and what I'm going to do about it. And so she was an amazing figure, and a national figure, not the political high honchos, a lot of publicity, but quietly, she was our real leader. And I think the people sensed it. Minu told me, we were there for the last day, the 9 days of prayers, the last day is the big one. But she said for the actual burial, when they brought her back home, you know, to the countryside, they had her in the hearse. They brought her body through the town in the slow moving hearse. People came out of their houses. The men took off their hats. The women and kids threw flowers at the hearse as it went by. That it was the most moving demonstration of just affection and respect for her. So she is a huge figure. And I wrote an op-ed, an essay for the Dominican papers, called, you know, how not to let the butterflies die with this last butterfly. And it's the idea that spirit of the day, you know, that showing up, that, you know, activism by the way you live your life, you don't even have to go out and march or anything, is something that that we can keep alive beyond her death and the death of her sisters. And that's, you know, the only way I know how to pay tribute to the kind of person she was. But it is a huge loss. And I just heard from Minu, she says the hardest thing for her, that they died February 1st, is that whenever she goes out in public, she has her own private grief. She lost her mother, she lost her father, both revolutionaries, and now she loses Mama Dede. And she goes out in public, and of course people have to tell her how much they miss Dede and how, she says it's just mass grieving everywhere I go, you know, and so it's tough for her. Because she not just has the private loss, but the public. Very public. Very public loss. But people feel it. Right. You know? Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. I know we have to wrap up, so I guess my last question is, what's next on the horizon for you?
That is a hard question. I think I've been working on poems again. I often go back to, that's my first love, how I started. And to me, that's the place where I'm sort of pushing up against what I don't know. And I find that, you know, after working in a lot of prose and a lot of characters and a lot of situations and, you know, getting embroiled in so much language, I need to begin again. And the poetry returns me to that basic unit of each word. You know, Emily Dickinson said there's no approximate words in a poem. And I love that. I love that descent into the simplicities. Kunitz at 95 in his last book of poems has as a little introduction as something called Reflections, and he says that now imagine at 95 what he looks to write about are the great simplicities, you know, life, death, the movement of the seasons, friendships, loss, you know, the great simplicities. To get down to the bare bones of what a life is really about. So I think, you know, I'm working in poems now. I'm also feeling the clock ticking for myself and thinking, what do I want to do in the time left me with this craft I've developed over a lifetime? How to best use my resources so that when I, you know, die, there's not a drop of life left in me. I've used it up. And how can I, you know, the Toni Morrison quote that I love, the function of freedom is to free someone else. What can I do in the time left me? So these are questions that I don't have answers for. And I'm slowly finding my way, you know, in terms of at least the poems and thoughts, right, right? And, you know, I've always been a writer that my life takes me certain places, and I write out of that community and context and situation. I just was quoting to a group of writers the Charlie Parker quote, if you don't live it, it ain't gonna come out of your horn. And so I really feel like I'm a storyteller within community. And my community, more and more, I'm feeling, is the human family, because we gotta start thinking. I mean, start? We should be way ahead in, you know, framing our way of living to being a whole human family if we're going to survive. And so, you know, I out of that sense of that huge community and context, I'm sure something will arise. There's so many stories. It's just which one is the one marked for me to tell.
Thank you so much for chatting with me, Julia Alvarez, for KBOO Community Radio.
Thank you for having me here in Portland. Thank you.
That was Julia Alvarez, author of the memoir, A Wedding in Haiti, The Story of a Friendship. The music you've been listening to is by Piti himself, the main character in the memoir. The song is called Raise Your Hands High. Before we go, an announcement. The Portland Eco Film Festival kicks off on April 17th at the Hollywood Theater with the film Damnation and continues with monthly screenings through September. The Eco Film Festival films cover topics of nature conservation, environmental activism, agriculture, and community wellness. All screenings include a filmmaker Q&A or a panel discussion with local experts designed to engage audience participation and activism for environmental advocacy. All shows are at the Hollywood Theater, located at 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. For more information, visit hollywoodtheater.org or call 503-493-1128. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_studio or tweet us at @stage_studio. This has been Sarika Mehta with Stage and Studio. Thanks for listening.
kutmo kape bagay sayo. Lukali na tibi. Bisa bote onde. Ano betete nuwa salepe.
Bebe nuwa ne. Kon reme si konte. Kusa te tinu yo. Yo tu se verite. Bebe me nuwa ne. Kon reme si konte. Kusa te tinu yo. Yo tu se verite.
KBOO is looking for a membership director. Duties include database management, conducting mailings, producing reports, assisting members managing pledge drives, and of course, working closely with other staff members here at the station. The ability to work with numerous people in a fast-paced environment is essential. This is a mix of part-time and full-time work, with 40 hours per week being required leading up to, during, and following each membership drive. A full benefit package is included. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Our organization does not discriminate on the basis of age, race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, sexual orientation, class, creed, physical or mental disability. For a more detailed job description and printable job application, go to kboo.fm, search for hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G. And to apply, please send a resume via email to hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G, at kboo.org. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guests are architectural writer Brian Libby and the architects Peter Meijer and Becca Cavell. Peter is a principal with Peter Meijer Architecture, and Becca is a principal at Thomas Hacker Architects. They're here today to talk about the Portland Building, Memorial Coliseum, and the Gasco Building on Highway 30, and whether there is a case for preserving such Portland landmarks. Welcome to KBOO. Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian, I'll start with you. These three buildings we've picked out, they're all under some kind of threat and they're all well known. And just tell us a little bit about the first one, the Portland Building.
Well, the Portland Building has tremendous international significance as pretty much the first major building in the world as part of the postmodern architectural movement of the 1970s and 80s that was kind of a reaction to modernism that had dominated architecture for a lot of the decades beforehand. And it has a kind of sense of whimsy and color and an embrace of historic styles of the past, but in maybe kind of a cartoonish way. It's maybe appropriate that the lead-in to the show here was David Bowie's Andy Warhol song, because I think of the Portland Building as kind of like the Andy Warhol Brillo boxes of architecture. Mm-hmm. It was announced a few weeks ago that the building would need something like $95 million in repairs, and so it gave the City of Portland City Council a cause to do some hand-wringing and say, you know, is it worth it to restore this building? Because as internationally significant as the Portland Building is, at the same time, it's by anyone's estimation, not a very hospitable place to work in. It has just about no natural light, and studies have shown that city employees in the building have higher rates of sick leave, and so people don't want to work there. And so the city council was sort of saying, you know, what if we spend $95 million on a white elephant? So it's interesting for that reason that rarely do you have a building that is so significant in terms of the history of architecture, but is actually not very well constructed.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what's your take on that building? I mean, we know that it was done by Michael Graves.
Yes, that's correct, in the 80s, and it was Michael Graves' first major work of architecture that really set the tone for his rest of his career, and it really changed it marked the end of mid-century modernism and the black box and started looking at architecture in a very more creative light. And it's absolutely interesting that the love-hate relationship, there really is no middle ground on this building. People either love it or hate it. And you find, if you dig a little deeper into that, that the people who really dislike it really are those that have worked in it and have operated it and tried to maintain it. And then if you look at those who would fall on the love side of it, is because they recognize that Portland has this incredible defining piece of architecture in its own backyard. It was a building that, before it was even constructed, was internationally well known, documented in across the board in all the medium as a significant piece of architecture. And so it's interesting that we are in a point of time where the building is very young. It's 30 years old, from the 80s. And are we at a point of those of us now in a position to make a determination of its future, if that future means that the building should be compromised? And by that, I mean perhaps it's not demolished, but it's changed to fix the problems. Because just to correct one of Brian's statements, there has been a structural study done, and that structural study was very well written and very well performed, and it analyzed and it put to rest the fact that the building at the time it was built very well. If you compare any 1980 building to the seismic codes of 2013, it's going to come up short. It does have problems. And if you look at the numbers associated with those problems, it's significantly less than the $95 million. But I think the real question is, and not really the price of it, but whether or not, in the terms of this morning, whether or not it is a significant building that efforts should look into it. Well, how do you get to the heart of the problems, and why is it that people hate this building locally and love it internationally?
Becca, have you been in this building, the Portland building?
I have. It used to have the city's permit office in it. And so all of the architects in town probably have spent quite a lot of time in there pulling permits for their projects. Those have moved out. And I don't have the pleasure or displeasure of going in there quite as often as I used to. It's I think both Brian and Peter have noted that it's a flawed building, and it is particularly disliked by the people that work in it. Mm-hmm. Peter and I have debated it in public a couple of times, because I've gone on record saying I think the building should be torn down. Mm-hmm. I think that my position is actually a little more tempered, because Peter has, I think, some great points about the building. Mm-hmm. But if a building has a future, it has to have a useful life. And as an office building, it is quite inhumane for the people who work in it, for a variety of reasons. Probably the biggest issue being the windows, not just the fact there isn't enough natural light, there also isn't enough access to views. And people need to be able to see out of the places that they work
in. Right, because it's got thick walls, right? The windows are small and recessed.
The windows are small and high.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they're particularly small. Even if you look at the building from the outside, it appears to have large areas of glass through the middle of it and little square windows to the sides. Mm-hmm. But that glass is not windows, the large pieces of glass. I think there's one room in that entire vertical space that actually has decent windows.
Oh, okay. I remember the Oregonian did a piece about it like 10 years ago, and they talked to Graves and he said, well, it's not my fault. You know, I didn't have the budget for lots of windows.
Yeah, I don't really think that...
Is there any truth to that?
Well, he has... That is... I don't know if it's an urban myth, but that certainly has been out there quite a lot. The windows are also a little dark. They're dark glass, and so mm-hmm. that doesn't help. So there are some discussions about what could be done to improve the windows. Peter and I stood outside the building a month or two ago and were talking about how to make them bigger. It's challenging. I personally think that what should happen, it's very rare for a building that's considered historic, even though it's only 30 years old, to have its architect still living. And Michael Graves is still alive and still very opinionated, and I think that he could probably help figure out how to make it a viable building.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating that we're having a debate and we're talking about this building, because from get-go, from day one, the competition which led to the winning selection of this building had the exact same debate about the window size and about the style of the building and what could be done with the resources that were available. So I think we have to be very careful that we're not blaming the resources that were available and the results of the competition outline, because of the three proposals that were, there was only one that met the public criteria for the whole program as well as the budget, and that was the one that eventually got built. I think what we're seeing now, though, is once we're working in that building and once we're observing how it's moving around, it's not functioning very well from the user standpoint. And so, as Becca mentioned, Michael Graves is alive. This is a very important building for him. And he has had thoughts about how to address the windows. He has had thoughts about how to address the ground floor. And he has had 30 years to think about this building. And so,